Silent Waves contains material that may be distressing for some listeners. If any of the content is triggering for you, please refer to the support organisations in our show notes. Act 2.
She's been through a lot, this girl. She's won it all. She's made it into the Maritime Museum, and she's a great athlete, great swimmer. And here are her friends enjoying themselves in the pool. In the pool, here they are.
It's summer 2006.
I hadn't seen Leonardo since 1994. The memories that I had of him was first as a baby, then as a toddler until I left Brazil. Yeah, I was excited. It was my first member of the family coming to visit me or stay with me in Australia. So I was quite excited. I do remember that I said, wow, you are so big now. You know, I could never imagine seeing, you know, him the way that he was, and he was really, really affectionate to me and all of that. So I was quite happy, but I was quite surprised because my connection with him was like he was a stranger, really, because I didn't know him as that Leonardo. The Leonardo that I knew was a little boy, really.
I couldn't wait to meet my cousin Leonardo. Mom had told me he was a professional hip-hop dancer, and I loved dancing. I remember the day. It was summer 2006, the start of school term in my first year of high school. I just turned 13. He picked my younger brother Matt and I up from school with Mum, and I wanted to know everything about him. He seemed enamoured by my eagerness.
I remember we met him, and I remember being pretty excited because how old would I have been, like 10 or 11 or something? And just by the nature of being that young, whenever you meet someone who's older than you, you generally think that they're cool. They're going to be like a role model. They're a bit more relatable to you than your parents are, I guess. So I was excited. Also, by way of tracing back roots a little bit, I think I was always thought it was cool that I was Brazilian. All the girls in primary school did too, so I wanted to own that a little bit by getting to know him. I thought he was a cool dude. He wanted to hang out with me. I don't know, I got along with him. I considered him a friend. We'd laugh together. Yeah, I liked him.
With Leonardo around, home life got more exciting. It was a break from our routine. I wanted to spend as much time with him as I could. You still, obviously, because he's your family, and family are people that you generally trust. So would you say that you instantly trusted him, and for all you knew, he was a good person?
Of course, absolutely, you know, especially thinking about how I was brought up by my parents. I never would think not trusting, you know, no one's perfect, no family perfect, we know that, but our family, like my brothers and sisters, we were brought up with values and respect and a lot of things, so I never thought of anything apart from trust him. Absolutely trust him. Yes, yes.
My name is Raquel O'Brien, and this is Silent Waves.
The first time I met Leonardo, I remember being introduced to him as Raquel's cousin, who had come over from Brazil. And was staying for a while.
This is my friend Rosie. As teenagers, we were inseparable. If I wasn't at her house, she'd be at mine.
Over a few times that I was over, and I was over very regularly, I found him very creepy. He was always very interested in Raquel. I always found him staring at her and very controlling and possessive over her. Because we sat on the couch a lot and played SingStar, Mario Kart, that kind of thing. And she had this long couch and we were always sitting on it. Then they had a recliner chair. And I remember he was sitting on this chair and he was just, he wouldn't laugh. He wouldn't really get involved, but he would stare at Raquel. And I always thought that was a little bit creepy.
I was aware of the staring. And he'd also compliment me whenever we were alone. He'd tell me how beautiful I was, and it made me feel as if I was the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen. I enjoyed being flooded with his attention. I was 13. My cousin was 25. I'm 25 now. In no time, Leonardo's gaze crossed over to touch, in the form of carinho. Carinho loosely translates to caressing in Portuguese. It's when you stroke another person with the tips of your fingers.
Oh, carinho is like one of my favorite things about Brazilian culture. It is what mum used to do when we were younger. It's pretty much like caressing. Carinho is like a very, I don't know, it's weird. It's very non-sexual by way of children, but then it can be taken sexually as you mature, I guess. But it's very much just like intention basis. The hug and a kiss can be sexual and non-sexual. Carinho is like my heroin. Like, I love it. And I used to just like lie on the ground and force mum to give me carinho still to this day.
It wasn't strange for me to receive carinho from Leonardo. I liked it. Looking back now, it was strange because he only gave it to me.
I remember just because Leonardo was from Brazil, I think you'd spoken about getting carinho from him or something. And I asked him for carinho and he was like, oh no, guys don't give other guys carinho kind of thing. So it was very weird that he was unable to express that connection, that kind of sensitivity with a young boy. I think for him, it was either it's sexual or it's nothing.
Leonardo would often drop me off and pick me up from places. In our car rides, our conversations turned sexual. He insisted that he could teach me things, that I was coming to an age that I needed to explore my sexuality. He told me boys at school would like it and that I could learn it all in a safe environment with him. I would thank him for his offer and politely decline. I was happy with the carinho. The next thing I knew, Leonardo would wake me in the middle of the night, giving me carinho. Tell me he was lonely and that he couldn't sleep. I thought he was missing his family. I didn't mind. I was happy to be stroked back to sleep. In order for me to understand the psychology of what happened to me, I reached out to professionals and academics with extensive knowledge of child sexual abuse.
I think that the role of grooming is central to the whole sexual abuse process.
This is academic Kathy Humphreys. She's the Professor of Social Work at the University of Melbourne.
Because what perpetrators of abuse want is actually a compliant victim. They actually want the victim to be able to say that they are a willing victim rather than, in fact, someone that has been forced into unwanted sexual assault. It becomes central to what the abuser wants to make sure that the victim is compliant.
Grooming. It's taken me 10 years to understand the concept.
And so there's processes which are used by perpetrators to suck the victim in to a web in which they feel as though they can't get out. So part of grooming, it's like a spider web, is to catch the victim into the web so that they cease to struggle. But for many of these perpetrators, the grooming process is also part of what turns them on.
I got used to my cousin's nightly visits. They became a ritual between us. Mum had never given me carinho on my chest before, though. That was new to me. Slowly and carefully, he introduced touching me in new places. He'd tell me to relax and enjoy how good it felt.
People often think that sexual assault of children and some teenagers is a very violent act, but it isn't usually.
This is Caroline Worth, manager for the Southeastern Centre Against Sexual Assault in Victoria, also known as CASA.
It's a matter of getting a child used to behaviours they might have been uncomfortable with initially, and then you just slowly introduce other things and they become comfortable with that. And eventually you can, you know, end up at the point that you want to be if you're the person grooming them. There hasn't been anything violent in that at all, unless you say, per se, that sort of violent itself. But it hasn't been the sort of violence that leaves bodies or marks on your body or anything like that. It's much more a gentle manipulation of people so they're not uncomfortable with what's occurring.
Because I froze and didn't fight back, I carried the weight of responsibility with me.
To put the responsibility on the child to protect themselves or for a child to say no, it just shows extraordinary ignorance.
This is renowned Victorian lawyer Dr. Judy Courtin. She works extensively with victims of institutional child abuse.
If a person is vulnerable, regardless of their age, and there is a power discrepancy or, you know, a significant power discrepancy between an offender and a victim, we cannot expect that the vulnerable person is going to be able to protect themselves. It's the nature of the beast. They are so clever, they will hone in on only the vulnerable. And that's what makes an offender.
I started to feel very confused. On one hand, it didn't feel right, but on the other, I had someone older assuring me that what was happening was harmless, normal behaviour. Anytime I voiced concern, he'd say, "But it feels good, right?" It did. All I knew is whatever we were doing together. It was part of our special bond. Here's Caroline Worth again.
One of the problems with grooming as opposed to a one-off violent assault is that it actually affects every part of your life. So what it really does is change your childhood because you have somebody who, if they're really very good at it, makes you the special child and then isolates you out from your siblings or from your mum and your grandparents or other people. So then what you become used to is being that special child. There are some strings attached to being the special child, but there are often enough good things attached that you sort of go along with the yucky bits as well. So you end up, when someone's older, them feeling they were complicit in it.
Leonardo arrived in January 2006. In March, my mum's family in Brazil called.
So I got a phone call from my sister to say that my mum was very ill and she was in intensive care. I hadn't been to Brazil for 9 years at that time, so I decided that I had to go because if my mom died, I would never forgive myself. So I went to Brazil.
I remember it was around that time that Leonardo started luring me into his bedroom. He'd put me in his double bed. He was more comfortable there. In his room, he pushed the boundaries further. He started asking me to do things to him so he could teach me how to do it right. I'd resist and he'd persist. Then he'd wake me up before sunrise so I could go back to my own room. A few hours later, I'd get up for school. Then there was a slip. Matt was there.
I remember waking up. It probably would have been around sometime in the early morning, I guess, past midnight, I would say. I woke up, I was half awake, and I saw Leonardo leading you into the room and you were half asleep as well. You were at my level. I was literally up for 10 seconds maximum. Saw it happen, thought it wasn't a big deal, went back to sleep.
Even in our sleeping state, we locked eyes. I was petrified. I didn't want Matt to dob on me. And if he did, what would my dad think of me then? That morning, Leonardo forgot to wake me up. My dad burst through the door, demanding answers. Leonardo jumped in, gave his alibi. She was crying. She missed her mum, and she came to me for comfort. It worked. During the nights with Leonardo, I would imagine I was floating above my body, in the clouds. That way, I could pretend that what was happening wasn't happening to me. I spoke to Graham Taylor, a specialised trauma psychologist, who says that this is a common coping mechanism.
If trauma occurs at an early age, when a child is quite helpless, one of the things that can often happen is that the brain's own protective mechanism kicks in, and in extremes, person can, we use the term dissociate, to put that memory out of awareness. It's not that it's not there, and it can be reactivated, of course, by current events, but the person may not have a clear recollection later of earlier things.
While I didn't know the term at the time, this was when I began to disassociate, block things out. But within weeks of the incident in Leonardo's room, there was another slip. Matt explains.
Ever since I was young, I was computer savvy.
Okay.
I would watch porn. I would know how to delete my browser history because I didn't want people knowing that I watched porn.
Okay, so
I knew exactly where the files were. I went into the deleted or half downloaded areas. I was like, there's pedophilia. And I was like, I didn't realize at the time that the philia at the end was still, I was like, that sounds really pedophile. I didn't know pedophilia was the noun. I was like, oh, what the fuck is this shit? I opened it and it was like a webcam shot of looking straight ahead at a bed in a really barren room. I just skipped through it, but it was definitely a younger bodied female, 12 to 16, I would say. But for me, see, that didn't look as weird because I was that age. I was like, oh, that's what girls look like. So I couldn't pinpoint exactly, but just riding on top of some dude. Straight away, I turned it off because I was like, whoa, what the fuck is that? And then I just called Dad. I was like, you have to have a look at this. And I was like, I just found this on the computer. It's not me, because if it was me, I wouldn't show you. And at the time, I think there were some suspicions because Leonardo used to go into your room a little bit. So there were some suspicions there. I showed Dad, and Dad was just like, what the fuck, where's your girl? Make sure Raquel's safe, blah, 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 blah.
Dad brought it up in the car on the way to school.
He said, Raquel, has Leonardo molested you? One of those look into my eyes and tell me kind of situations, but through a rearview mirror. His approach probably came more from anger, I would say, than empathy. I think he was more concerned about the direct issue than your well-being, so therefore approached it in a manner that was more about confronting Leonardo than understanding your perspective.
And do you remember my response at all in the car?
To me, it was convincingly no.
My dad's reaction showed me that what was happening was wrong. I thought I was to blame. Now I know a child can never give consent.
Dad didn't want to act until Mum got back because he thought that it would look bad if he made accusations without running it by Mum first.
Interesting.
Because it's her family and he doesn't want to intrude on her family.
I wanted to know what my dad had told my mum.
He told him that he had found child pornography and he questioned Leonardo about, and he denied and saying that he actually was a virus that he got. If he thought that something was happening in terms of molestation between Leonardo and you, that he should have acted upon straight away. Because first he was a lawyer. He was quite knowledgeable about the criminal part of the child pornography. And also, you or his daughter. And he should have not wait for me. He should have acted straight away.
It's clear to me now that a duty of care was not met. A crime went unreported. And as my mum said, my dad was a lawyer. How could he turn a blind eye? The atmosphere at home got tense. My dad was intentionally making Leonardo stay uncomfortable. I thought he must have known. It got so bad that Leonardo moved out within a month. Mum got back soon after. She'd been gone for 3 months. Home life resumed to normal. The issues surrounding Leonardo had, from my perspective, been resolved. Or as I see it now, swept under the rug.
You always think about strangers. You know, you hear about people. You never think that's going to happen in your own family unit, you know? Of course no, you know? How do you know really? That's why after things happen and you start think, oh, now you start becoming aware because you start not trusting. You start not trusting. It doesn't matter who it is because you know now. It doesn't matter, you know? It doesn't matter who it is. If you feel uncomfortable, if you know, it's not right.
We must change the discourse around familial sexual abuse. When we think about child sexual abuse, we think churches, schools, or sporting teams. Very rarely do we consider families. Here's Dr. Judy Corden again.
Absolutely. The family is an institution. And I think the elements within a family, the same elements within a religious institution or a school, in that there are children and the children are vulnerable, they don't understand. And you will get, of course, a person with a lot of power, and it's the abuse of that power over the vulnerable child that creates the requisite ingredients, if you like, for abuse and exploitation. So in that sense, yes, those elements we see through any form of institution.
But in support services, familial sexual abuse is well known.
Abuse within the family is a much larger issue than institutional abuse.
This is Kathy Kazelman, a survivor of familial sexual abuse and president of Blue Knot Foundation. It's a national organisation that works to improve the lives of the 1 in 4 Australian adults who've experienced childhood trauma.
And it's often been seen as sacrosanct, you know, what happens within the family, and family secrets belong to the family. I mean, that needs to be exploded, and, you know, we need to start to break down the bastions of secrecy and understand that if we believe a child is being harmed or at risk of harm, that we speak up, that, you know, family business is not secret. And we need to start to encourage having conversations in our society within families or friends or workplaces about abuse and violence.
In time, Leonardo returned to being a part of our family. The past was laid to rest. In Brazilian culture, your home is always open. Within the year, Leonardo was sleeping over again. As shameless as abusers prove themselves to be, my cousin continued from where he'd left off. There was a 2-year period in my life in which I was regularly sexually abused by my cousin. There was nothing that I was not stripped of, my virginity included.
A few times looking back now I know what had occurred. There were little things that had happened that really made me think that something was going on.
My friend Rosie remembers the time we went to Rottnest Island for my birthday. We spent 4 days riding bikes and exploring all the beaches.
And her cousin Leonardo and another cousin, they came with us because obviously we needed somebody older because we had a chalet there. And Raquel was very, very protective of Josie, Sasha and I when we were there. She kept on saying, I remember this, repeatedly saying that we're all sleeping in this room, like, please stay away from my cousins, and kept on reinforcing the fact, please stay away from my cousins. And like, we had no interest, but obviously she knew what her cousin Leonardo was capable of.
I wanted to protect my friends, other young girls, from my cousin, to contain the abuse to me. I'd been wounded. It was the first time that I met trauma.
The word trauma comes from the Greek word meaning wound or injury.
Rob Gordon is a clinical psychologist who's worked with trauma and disasters throughout Australia and New Zealand for over 30 years.
So a psychological trauma is when an experience is of sufficient intensity that it damages my ability to process and digest it. And that's why it doesn't go away, because normally an experience should fade into memory. So I remember in the past, I had a bad experience, and at the time, I felt very distressed. Whereas when I've had a trauma, I can't do that. Every time it comes back, it's as fresh and raw and distressing as it was in the beginning. And there's no sense of moving on. And that's what leads to what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, which is the stress of this continually happening that disrupts my life.
Back then, I was determined to move on. My cousin didn't fit the description of what I thought a rapist was, a stranger in a white van, and therefore I didn't see him as one. I minimized my abuse and convinced myself its hold on me would pass in time.
I've learned that healthy people can simply put a certain amount of trauma aside and do nothing with it. But that takes energy. And it probably means that some energy is immobilizing this bad experience and they can get on and lead fairly productive lives, but at a certain cost. But when they have a subsequent trauma or bad experience, then it overloads them. They don't have the spare resources to deal with it.
I thought Leonardo would be the last trauma I would know. But my dad was up to something. It had to do with money again. And the repercussions would traumatize my whole family. Next time on Silent Waves.
It was like the most amount of money I'd ever seen in my life. Fuck me, like, what is all this money?
And then he said, oh, well, just calm down, he's saying to me. I said, I can't calm down. And I said, my God, what did you do with the money?
And everyone's calling me going, hey, I just heard this on the radio, is that you? And I'm like, yep, what's going on? I was like, some shit going on here.
If you've been enjoying listening to Silent Waves, please subscribe, rate, and leave us a review to help spread the message. Silent Waves is created and produced by Raquel O'Brien and me, Georgina Savage, in partnership with Nearly Media. The show is hosted by Raquel, and I'm the editor. Music production by IMXO of Alt Music Group, with audio assistance by Lloyd Richards and Charlie Vonnox. Our graphic design is by Stacey Gugulis.